Hi, everyone. This is Janet Gupfield, Executive Director of the Scottsdale Institute. Thank you all for joining us today. As you know, we've been holding a COVID-19 teleconference series focusing on those issues in particular that help transfer knowledge across markets, but also just in terms of maintaining the key infrastructure that's needed to support your increasingly remote workforce as you deal with COVID and the social isolation policies. So nothing is more relevant for us today than, in fact, this topic of how do you support an expanded remote workforce during COVID-19, but also thereafter. And leading us in today's conversation will be our partners' impact advisors, and in particular, Shefali Mukuncheri, who is the principal and the virtual security information cybersecurity information officer for Impact Advisors, and Eric Girard, principal and also a virtual chief technology officer for Impact Advisors. I think you'll appreciate what Shefali and Eric have pulled together in terms of what it takes to scale a large remote workforce. And the conversation at the end, I'm sure we'll all be interested in hearing your feedback or questions you might have. And at that point in time, you'll be prompted to just press 5-star, and then we'll unmute your line and have you join the conversation. So Shefali and Eric, thank you so much for leading us in this important conversation. I'll turn it over to you, and you can start at any time.
Great. Thank you so very much. Hi, Eric Girard here, and thank you for the lovely intro and the opportunity. I think this is such a timely topic, and I have to tell you that we're discussing this with many, many of our clients. People are getting things started. People are already down this path. People are asking a lot of questions, and I think this is just very pertinent to everything that's going on today. Our intention today is to walk through and identify some of the challenges that everybody is facing currently, and then talk about some of the infrastructure and security considerations. Because this is, as you've seen in the news, this is a highly dynamic environment right now. It literally, many teams are doing daily huddles and weekly conferences for their organizations. And as you watch the news, you see how things are evolving. It literally is almost a day-by-day and sometimes hour-by-hour change in what's going on in the world. And so I think being able to try and anticipate some of those needs and make sure that you're looking and considering all the right things from both an infrastructure and security standpoint are going to be key to making this successful and ultimately, in some cases, an ongoing process. I'll let Shefali kind of do a quick update on the security side, and then we'll get going around our problem statement.
Great. Yeah, thank you, Eric. And so there are so many concerns related to cybersecurity, and we look at remote work. We are looking at telemedicine, telework, telehealth, however you want to flavor it, but it's all remote. And so there are definitely concerns of bandwidth, perhaps even outsourcing for resources related to additional monitoring of logs and events and then mitigation. How do you really tell you have the right email in front of you? Is it a phishing email? And all these concerns that surround security now more than ever as we see more and more phishing email attacks. We see the sophistication in how these emails are crafted. But I will also talk about some of the other things we're seeing in the industry as far as cyber attacks that are on the back end versus user facing. And so we'll go with that. And Eric, on slide 5.
Thank you, Shefali. Yeah, so slide 5, what we want to try and identify is a couple of key topics here. So how are your employees collaborating and communicating, because your goal, obviously, is for them to remain effective and efficient at what they do. And then are these tools and workflows, are they secure, scalable, and manageable? You know, certainly anybody can put something in place in the short term and get it out there quickly, but is it secure? Can you scale up? And then two very, you know, big differences between taking a clinical approach versus a non-clinical approach. And we're going to try and address both to a certain degree today. And then, of course, long term, are you going to be able to go back to business as usual? Would you want to go back to business as usual? You know, and what are the ramifications on this on a long term basis? Because I think there's definitely going to be some changes in how we do business. So how we tee this up today can make a big difference on the ability to extend this on a long-term basis, and what might the benefits be. So if we move to slide six real quick, this is representational and has only a couple of the key vendors right now, clearly Zoom being a very favorite one, but I'll be honest with you, as you've heard and Shefali will address, there's a variety of security concerns around Zoom. Obviously, Google Classroom is not going to be pertinent to our dialogue, but certainly a lot of our organizations are using Zoom. They are using Google. They're using Microsoft Teams. They're using WebEx. There's a variety of tools out there and available. And as you can see, the increased usage is just phenomenal. I mean, I remember reading even just a couple of weeks ago how some of the downloads were literally, you know, over 60 million downloads of some of these tools for people to be able to access and have teleconferencing capabilities. And, of course, the thing to keep in mind is many of these are cloud-based. So then that raises, you know, your concerns, or at least you should be able to address any of those security issues that may be a part of that. So, on slide seven, let me just take a moment about the infrastructure considerations, okay? So there's kind of two approaches here. One is collaboration. One is application access, okay? And we're going to kind of dig into both of these along the way. So for collaboration, obviously, and here's what I want to put on the table right away, is invariably most organizations have some level of collaboration tool already available. Now, the question gets to be is that something you can expand and use on an ongoing basis, as well as for a larger audience? Typically, you know, when I think about our use of any of these collaboration tools, whether it's WebEx or Teams or whatever, you know, it's more for sometimes occasional use or incremental use as opposed to the broader use that we're going to see today. So the question gets to be is that scalable? Can you increase and accommodate that load? So part of the question gets to be is, if it's cloud-based, obviously much easier to scale. If it is in your data center, well, now you've got to take a look at your capacity capabilities and what you might need to do to expand that capacity. And then same with application access. In many cases, you know, most of our EHR systems are delivered through some sort of virtual technology, whether it's Citrix and XenApp, or whether it's VMware's VDI or RDSH, you typically already have some level of virtualized application delivery or VPN capability. And there's a big difference between accessing via VPN versus a virtualized delivery mechanism. And again, it kind of gets down to, first off, you want to leverage what you have in place today because you know it, you own it, you've got a level of familiarity with it, and you've already taken into, hopefully, consideration the security aspects of some of that. But it gets down to also network bandwidth. You know, what was good for small, low-level usage of remote access to these applications or remote capabilities for your collaboration tool, do you need to bump your network bandwidth going out to the broader internet? And I think, you know, this is something that, you know, until people start complaining, you often don't take into consideration. So making sure you stay ahead of that curve, working closely with your network team, working closely with your internet service provider and your bandwidth provider to ensure that you have ample bandwidth, because what was a pretty small pipe usage previously now could become a massive bottleneck. And then, of course, support. You know, you're now asking people to work from home, and the support of people out of their house, I'll tell you, as the CTO for our organization, I have been getting numerous calls from people who have been able to work, you know, fine in many situations, but all of a sudden, you know, they may or may not be that familiar with our conferencing tool, okay, and how do I do a certain thing? And so I'll be honest with you, our service desk has taken a bump in increase in calls looking for help with these capabilities. So making sure that you have your service desk well-staffed and clear on the capabilities and some of the nuances and even some of the more advanced functions is going to be critical. Let me hand this over to Shefali for slide 8, because I think a lot of this also just not only is infrastructure oriented, but there's some very important things you have to take into account from a security perspective.
Thank you, Eric. So on slide 8, as organizations transition their resources to remote work, there are certain security considerations that must be addressed by organizations. These may include inventorying what applications remote workers are using. Will some of these be cloud-based? What security risks is an organization willing to accept? You may have had to put video conferencing tools in place immediately for continuity of care, for telehealth. And so what risk is an organization willing to take on? Also, on March 20th, the Office of Civil Rights, OCR, published a HIPAA waiver discretion. And so with that, there were some guidance that was provided to providers that basically said that they will waive certain HIPAA waivers or provisions that allow for the use of telehealth video conferencing tools. They specifically named which ones were allowable, but as we know with Zoom for Health, there's different versions of Zoom that there have been security issues with Zoom. If you are using Zoom, would recommend that you have a unique meeting ID, your link is encrypted, you use the waiting room function, that would be enabled. You also may have integrated Zoom with, say, an EHR. And if you've done that, then you're definitely going to want to encrypt the communications, prevent any recordings from happening unless it's absolutely necessary and that your organization has developed a policy and procedure that allows for this type of recording. One thing in this discretion that was published by the Office of Civil Rights talks about a video conferencing tool being HIPAA compliant. Don't confuse HIPAA compliant for the sake that, oh yes, I have encryption. The HIPAA waiver discretion goes into specific detail and calls out something called end-to-end encryption. So let's say if you and I were on a Zoom conference call, I have my session open, you have your session open. But in between, there's space, and that space can be hijacked by any Zoom employee. They would be able to spy on your conversation without you knowing it. So with end-to-end encryption, the entire communication is encrypted, whether it's with your connection, my connection, or in between. And so that is the other piece of this OCR discretion that many organizations should be paying attention to. Zoom was in trouble because they did talk about having what they call transport encryption. It's when the communication is at rest and in motion, but not in between. So I wanted to point that out, and I'm sure that we will see that there might be other video conferencing vendors that may come out with, yes, we are fully end-to-end encrypted, and just as an organization, verify that is the case. So there are different interpretations of this discretion, and so as an organization, please review this waiver discretion and put together your position on what this means for your organization. It should be reviewed by security, privacy, compliance, and legal departments, and please also bring in your health information management, HIM departments, too. They have a piece of this as part of patient authorization and consent, too. So each organization may want to explore also if two-factor or multi-factor authentication can be implemented as a security control. It is important to understand what devices are being used and how these devices will be managed in the remote environments. Some might be at home, some might be at a library, some might be in someone's car. How do you manage those locations? So how will these devices be secure? Is the connection method secure? Is there end-to-end encryption for your video conferencing tool that you're using? So organizations will have to develop policies to govern the use of video conferencing tools. Also, how will your policies be communicated? Is the marketing department going to be involved to draft a user-friendly communication? Will it be clinical? Will it be non-clinical? With the different healthcare models we have out there, whether you're an academic medical center or a two-man physician practice, what does this mean to you? Are you going to allow remote employees to print and scan PHI, say, at home? And if you do, I do know there are several organizations that allow it, but there are very strict controls in place such that if you have your screen open with PHI, that if you walk away, that you log off completely so that no family member is able to view your screen. Also, some things that organizations have done is that they will have the user save any files on a desktop, the remote desktop, versus on your laptop's drive. The other thing to think about is, because you don't have control over what's happening outside of the organization, how do you prevent misuse? Policies, procedures, and setting standards. So as remote employees print and scan, what will your communication be to them? And how will you hold them accountable? Perhaps you might have a user acknowledgement form where they actually have the do's and don'ts of working remotely and that they have to read all privacy and security policies, and by having an electronic signature, that formalizes the process and perhaps that form becomes part of their HR file. And so working from home can affect several areas within a healthcare organization, specifically scheduling, billing, and coding functions. So do you have a policy in place that addresses shredding PHI at home or any other remote location? Eric will now provide guidance on scaling remote access on slide 9.
Thank you very much, Polly. So this is a process, and in order to put this process together, what we're trying to outline on slide 9 is the different steps that we recommend that you take in order to do this. And we're going to walk through each one of these steps as we go through our time this afternoon. Obviously, building out a cross-functional team, and we're going to get into the details of that because, you know, oftentimes it's like, quick, check, take care of this. Well, it's more than just check, okay, and we're going to dig into some of that. Determining those requirements. So once you have your cross-functional team, you know, you're going to want to figure out, okay, what do we really want to be able to do? And part of that is also determining what you do not want to allow, okay? It's a two-part process there. At that point, now it's going to get supportive from the technology teams, identifying, okay, what's the technology that's going to enable our users to be able to do what they need to do? So it's what are the requirements? What is the technology, both from an application and from an infrastructure standpoint? And then you have to take a look at, okay, is this really going to serve all of our needs? And you're going to have to look at that cross-functional team to help determine, okay, is this going to work for our clinical, if it's going to work for our non-clinical, and it may vary by department and department. So looking at that and conducting that gap analysis. And at that point now, you're going to be able, you want to be able to educate and communicate. Okay, you need to put together a communication plan. You'll need to put together an education plan and making sure people understand how to use these tools and how not to, things to avoid when using the tools, just as Shefali was describing. Clearly, you want to test and validate that everything's going to work. Then you're going to want to launch this. And like I said, we're going to walk through each one of these steps as we go. But let me hand it over on slide 10 back to Shefali because she's got some really good specific things around security to get into here.
Great, thank you. On slide 10, you know, as the scaling of remote access capabilities are being determined and implemented, there are other security considerations to take in tandem, such as becoming an active participant in your organization's COVID-19 command center. And so usually a designated information security staff member or the chief information security officer should be participating. So if you're not, please ask to do so. There's so much involved with data and PHI that needs to be addressed. The information security department should also develop and implement various security policies related to remote work, telehealth, video conferencing, and a policy, an internal policy, on data loss protection tools, the DLP. It's basically a tool that helps to monitor email. And so once you have workers going from on-site to remote, you may have employees sending emails from the work email to, say, a Gmail account at home. And if there is PHI, the data loss protection tool will catch it and flag it and not let it go through to your home email. That's typically how it should work. And so internally, the information security department should develop a policy on considering what are true false positives. So, you know, will it be time consuming for the information security staff to go through these? Yes, but they will have to decipher out which ones need to be remediated and which ones are false positives. In addition, it's important to establish and communicate IT security standards related to telehealth, especially for internal IT security staff, providers, patients, researchers, educators, business associates, vendors, partners, and any other people, person, place, or organization that has an established relationship or role with your own organization. So these IT standards, they would include, say, a code of conduct for the staff at remote location. Some of the examples may include that the staff shred documents of PHI once those documents are no longer needed to get their job done. Other examples would be for staff to only use approved video conferencing tools, that staff read all privacy and security policies and procedures, that they call the help desk should they have any questions upon what's acceptable, what's not acceptable. And so once these IT security standards are developed and approved, the organization should determine the best path for communicating those to all staff. And it could be a global email or a specific form with an acknowledgement signature kept in the employee's HR file. Another consideration might be that the requirement to perform what we would call a security risk assessment on your telehealth vendor. You know, what would happen if you needed to implement a COVID-19 rapid test vendor in a very short period of time? You got a new vendor that can do COVID-19 testing. How would you get them vetted within your organization, and what would you consider secure? Or are you willing to accept the risk that they're not secure at this time, but that you circle back and look at their security later? So you will definitely have to put together security criteria to judge whether that system can be implemented securely. Also, as part of your COVID-19 initiatives, the organization may want to look at your disaster recovery and business continuity plans. What would happen if two-thirds of your security team was unable to perform their responsibilities? So these are some considerations to think about and develop your own strategy, policy, procedure, and plan. Eric will now take us to the next step on slide 11.
Thanks, Shefali. And, you know, when you mentioned business continuity, we think a lot from a technology perspective around disaster recovery. Okay, we lose a data center and things like that. Business continuity is perhaps a subject that we don't consider as well as we do disaster recovery, because it's a little more nebulous, it's a little harder to define, and quite frankly, what we're living right now is a classic business continuity situation. We have ability to access resources and capabilities, but because of COVID-19, you know, maintaining that continuity of business in a non-standard situation like this is something that I don't know that everybody has gone through and thought through as well. But certainly one of the lessons learned from this is, okay, next time this happens, what do we need to do and how do we need to be ready sooner and quicker? But going on to slide 11, building out that cross-functional team. Obviously, as Shefali just said, you've got to have IT security involved to understand and help provide guidance on what is safe and what is appropriate. The infrastructure team, you know, they're going to be able to help provide insights on what solutions may be available and the scalability of those solutions. But you want your leadership team involved as well, because they're the ones who are going to help communicate out and ensure that people are able to perform their capability, their work streams as well as possible. The clinical team, they're going to have a very distinct perspective on how they can and cannot do this. And, you know, we have seen some of these tools being used in some really unique ways for clinical teams. There's one that's actually, one of our clients is taking iPads, and they're using Microsoft Teams, and they've got a dedicated iPad for each room. And that iPad is locked down and set for that room, and it allows providers to provide interactive communication with those patients. There's been a lot of different approaches here. So getting involved with the clinical teams, because each clinical team may have a different set of needs and requirements, and understanding what those are is going to be critical. And the back office teams, you know, what does it take for the rev cycle to keep moving forward? The marketing people, you know, okay, right now communication is really key about your capabilities and you do and don't want your patients to do. You know, scheduling, very important. Accounts receivable, you know, we still need to be able to take that money in. What capabilities, what applications do they need to be able to access from home in order to keep the lights on and things moving forward? So if you move on to slide 12 about the requirements, let's talk about this for a second and touch base real quickly on the collaboration requirements. So a couple of things that have come up along the way. Okay, are you having a meeting that is strictly internal only? Well, there may be certain functionality, like, for example, if you have Microsoft Teams, unless you're paying for external access, it's an internal tool only. It's a very good internal tool, works really well, but unless you're paying a premium for that external access, that may be an internal-only tool, and making sure people understand that, versus an external tool like WebEx or GoToMeeting or something like that, which comes with a dial-in number. You know, is there a limitation on the maximum number of attendees for these conference calls? In some cases, you know, for example, if you're using the free version of Zoom, guess what? You've got a 40-minute time limit, and you've got a limitation on the number of users who can access this. So understanding how big the attendance might be. And the day-to-day calls and conferences might be small, but I also know that we do a weekly touch point with our entire firm, and getting several hundred people on a call all at once, you know, can tax both the infrastructure and the system, or may be limited by licensing. So understanding what your maximum number of attendees might be. And it's been interesting. So audio, when it comes to accessing the audio, obviously today we're all dialed in, but there are going to be times when you're doing conferencing where you're sharing a screen. And from an audio perspective, we've done some testing, and it very much depends on the person's internet access and bandwidth out of their house, and that is something you have no control over, but can play a key part. So, for example, I've discovered that if I use app either through my web browser with a headset plugged into my laptop, or I use the app on my phone, whether it's Microsoft Teams or GoToMeeting or almost any one of these, WebEx, whatever, the application actually gives me a better audio experience than if I actually dial in using a dial-in phone number, okay, to that same conference. And I literally have done that, where I've gone in, I've dialed in, I found that my connection was poor, I hang up, I open up the app, and all of a sudden I've got a crystal clear connection. So there can be a big difference on whether you use the app or the browser to access that meeting. Screen sharing. Some meetings will need screen sharing, some will not. Most applications, most conferencing applications have that capability, not a problem. Some applications may have a limitation on video capability. I know, for example, certain apps like GoToMeeting, you know what, the first 25 users in have video capabilities, but the next 100 do not and are dial-in only. And then there's also limitations around recording. You know, certain applications allow you to record a call like this one today. Others, that's an extra cost. And so if you want to take a look and understand the need for video record or audio recording, either one. But if recording is important, maybe it's just for select meetings, and maybe you can limit that cost and that need. But the ability to record could be an important factor as you work through your requirements. Application access. So there's a couple of ways to go about this. Are you going to be using VPN, virtual private networking, to access the applications, in which case they've got to have something on their laptop in order to access that through the VPN tunnel? Or are you going to be delivering this through a virtualized means such as Citrix or VMware? And there you've got, you know, part of it is you want to try and leverage what you already have in place today. I'm not suggesting that you go out and install something new. I want you to take advantage of what you have in place today. Like I said, because this is healthcare, we've all got some level of virtual capabilities because of our EHRs. And so expanding that capability, but then it gets to be, okay, as you develop your requirements, do people need access to a full desktop or just explicit applications? And that very well may be determined by their role, the team they're on, in the workflow that they have to follow. But again, taking advantage of how you normally deliver these. is key. We're not looking to work from a blank piece of paper, but simply expand and extend your current capabilities in a mindful manner. Now, the other part of it is, which users are going to need to leverage these tool sets, and what are those bandwidth requirements? If you need to make sure, again, checking with your internal teams around your network bandwidth to the internet, because that's how most people are getting to these over the internet from their homes. But if you have users that are having difficulty connecting, one of the first help desk questions I would ask is, what sort of bandwidth do you have available? Obviously, thankfully, we're no longer in the days of the 14-4 modem. Yes, I'm that old to remember that. Thank you very much. But, I remember personally having to increase my bandwidth years ago when my kids used to be doing online gaming. Thankfully, they're grown and gone, and we don't have that issue anymore. But you know what? I kept the bandwidth all to myself now. So I've got plenty of bandwidth. But not everybody does. Some of may be dependent on where they live and the capabilities of the providers in that area, or their willingness to pay for it. So understanding your users' bandwidth capabilities and setting perhaps minimums so they understand how to have as effective a session as possible in those applications that you're delivering. And then working through the training requirements. Not everybody has worked from home before. Now, we work in a consulting practice, so our people are used to working remotely part of the week. But not everybody's teams are used to that. So making sure that you provide some simple, easy-to-understand training on how to go about doing this, and then documenting that clearly and setting up your communication plan. And the communication should include, here's how you do things, here's what not to do, here's things we want you to be mindful of from a security perspective so that you help guide your people down the right path. And so I'm going to move on to slide 13 and let Shefali talk about some of those security considerations as you put together your requirements.
Great. Thank you, Eric. And so one of the things as we look at training and communication plans when they're being developed, another thing to think about is that, the Office of Civil Rights HIPAA waiver discretion talks about end-to-end encryption. So when you're looking at your workflows for telehealth, is it a computer-to-computer connection? Is it a phone via an app to a computer connection? And so when you're using the phone and to a computer connection, it is only partially encrypted, the part that's using the computer. When you call or use an app through the phone, it is going through the regular phone network, not a internet connection or a data connection. So one of those things to consider is how do you want to guide your employees to do telehealth? Is it a computer to computer, iPad to a computer? What is your organization willing to accept as the risk when you put these types of communication plans out there? Also, other considerations may be to review and modify your organization's website security. Double check who's got control of it, who's got the role of author, contributor, and any other roles. Also, review rules and alerts set for security. And also, is there someone in your organization reviewing those event logs and monitoring for vulnerabilities? One of the key considerations is to stay up to date on COVID-19 cyber scams and security alerts. I see a new one come out almost every other hour recently this week, and some cyber scams have included, fake emails stating that those emails were sent from the World Health Organization or the Centers for Disease Control. Cyber scams, they're getting more sophisticated, and I'll tell you an example where you might receive an email, looks legitimately from a government agency, but they'll say, here, enter your direct deposit account information here to get your stimulus check. Those emails are out there already. Also, I've heard of malicious actors now. They will actually mail you an infected USB drive, and it'll be sent to random people hoping to get people to insert it into their computers. Otherwise, it's important to review Homeland Security alerts and bulletins, review the Office of Civil Rights public notifications, and subscribe to the Office of Civil Rights Security listserv. There is a privacy listserv, too, but my world is all about security, so I do look at the security listserv because that's where a lot of the attacks are happening and more concern is being given to at this time. Another security consideration would be develop a plan that helps to prioritize and implement any of the mitigation activities related to COVID-19 cyber scams. As an example, what is the mitigation activity if a remote user submits an order for a personal protective equipment, a PPE, and charges it to the corporate Visa card because they wanted to buy, 200 PPE masks? And they put in the corporate Visa card, but then later discover it was a fake company, no order was actually placed, and the malicious actor now has the corporate Visa card information. So how do you, as a remote user, report it back to your organization? Are you scared that you're going to lose your job because this happened to you? Or is the organization going to say, we understand that there is a vulnerability out there, and here's how you should address it? So that way you can empower your remote users or workers. Also, one of the things to think about is that encryption during transmission. Now there is a requirement with Vice President Pence's letter to say that you have to, as an organization, provide your COVID-19 test results and report them out to the Department of Health and Human Services. So how will this information be transmitted securely to HHS? Will your organization consider a position on how that reporting will happen, say for mass surveillance? Recently, the University of California Healthcare Facilities, they published a COVID-19 dashboard. It's a summation of many of their University of California healthcare facilities throughout California and what their COVID-19 data looks like. Well, how did they get to that point? Did they aggregate the data? Did they blind the PHI? Did they include certain PHI? Who's got control of this data? And for security, how did all this aggregation happen? So those are some things to think about. And lastly, as an organization, you should be reviewing your user access control procedures for provisioning and deprovisioning staff. And in an unfortunate time that we are in now, that there are organizations that are furloughing employees. So what does security look like for those employees? Will you terminate their access, give them access to one or two systems that you still have them doing remotely? So those things are also needed to be considered. Furthermore, Eric will now describe technology considerations on slide 14.
Thanks, Shefali. So you've laid out your requirements, both from a security perspective and from an application access and conferencing perspective. You're working with the different teams because they're going to have very different needs. The applications that you're scheduling people will need access to are going to be very different than your clinicians. It will be very different from like rev cycle and collection folks. So now, okay, what have we got to determine? What technology is going to allow you to deliver that? In many cases, you may have certain applications already available virtually that you can expand and extend. But you know what? Odds are you don't have all of those applications ready to go and built out and tested. So taking those, once you identify those additional applications, now you've got to set those up and identify the technology and the best way to deliver those. Certainly on the collaboration side, if you're using cloud-based collaboration, then that makes it very easy to expand, assuming that the provider has the capability. Now, as we all know and as we all read, when this first kicked off, a lot of the providers thought they were on top of it. They found that they were not. And I can tell you, as a technologist, the toughest thing for most infrastructure technology is that initial logon. Once people get into the system, it settles down. But I've personally done testing on a variety of platforms, and it's that initial logon, for example, with an EHR, it's that 8 o'clock to 9 o'clock in the morning time that you get the highest spike in both utilization and stress on your infrastructure. Once people get in, it all settles down. So I recall a couple of weeks ago, both Microsoft and GoToMeeting and a few others were finding that, when people logged into meetings at the top of the hour, there was a lot of spinning wheels and waiting. And so what we recommended to people at the time was join 5 minutes early or 5 minutes late. But if you're at the top of the hour, you're going to have a slow login experience. So now, thankfully, most of them have the infrastructure capabilities expanded to alleviate that. But, if you have something like WebEx, you may be hosting that internally as opposed to in the cloud. And if that's the case, do you have the capacity to expand that to accommodate those additional users? Because it's going to be being used now far more than ever before. And I think moving on to slide 15 for a second, now you've got to take a look at, okay, what have I got, what do I need, and where do I have my gaps? Okay, because like I said, odds are you've got some of your applications available either through a virtual desktop or direct application delivery, but not likely to have all the ones that you needed because you've got groups now that have never worked remotely before, have never needed access outside of the office before. And so how do you expand that capability? You've got to determine, okay, is it even capable of delivering that? You know, there's certain applications that have some significant requirements that may not be available or readily deliverable through an individual application publication. They may have dependencies on other applications, in which case now you may have to do a desktop delivery. Do you have that capability in-house and the experience? You know, I mean, there's a big difference between sending out a single app versus a full desktop. And you may have variations on that desktop for the different departments so that you have perhaps a back office app that, you know, so for example, with your scheduling people, maybe you just have to publish your scheduling application. But for your rev cycle people, there may be a desktop because they need access to multiple applications. And so rather than send these out as an individual set of apps, publish a rev cycle desktop that now they can access and get everything they need quickly and easily. So you got to put those plans together to be able to deliver on that. Going to slide 16, you know, it's important because while these people may know how to use some of these applications, they may not know how to access them remotely. So, and I'll be honest with you, I love screenshot instructions. Take a screenshot, circle the pertinent parts, write a description, here's where you want to click, here's what you want to do, here's how you want to configure this, you know, on how to do everything from installing to launching and using these. And, you know, in some cases, you're going to have some users that are going to need advanced functionality. So at first, yes, you want to put the basics together, but you also may want to put an addendum at the end of that for advanced users. Here's how you do certain things. And that's all the more reason why you want that cross-functional team to be able to identify what those requirements and needs will be about allowing your users to be able to function as efficiently, as effectively at home as they do in the office. And, you know, this can be posted to an intranet. You may have a secure website that you want people to pull this information from. Obviously, from a security perspective, you don't want to broadcast this around the world. But, you know, it could be something that could be distributed by email securely. There's a couple of ways to get this information out to your users. You know, when we talk about IT security standards for telehealth across all functions and specialties, you know, Shefali's already touched on a lot of this, but making sure that, you know, users will gravitate to the easiest method for them that's possible. And it's important that while some things may be easier to do a certain way, they may not be secure. And making sure they understand that what they have to do is abide by your policies, especially at a time like this when it is so easy for bad people to take advantage of the situation. Obviously, you've got to have, you may have need or modify your existing consents for telehealth workflows and educating staff on phishing and cyber scams. Shefali's talked a lot about that, but we have seen an absolute uptick in cyber scams and phishing expeditions, and it can cause a lot of havoc. And this is a time that is already challenging for everybody. And as much as we can help make our people aware about how to avoid these pitfalls, it becomes that much more important. So moving on to slide 17, you know, I'm a firm believer in test again. You know, you want to make sure you test your basic functionality. We found that within certain capabilities, there's advanced functionality that doesn't work. We actually had to have some sit-down sessions with Microsoft about some advanced functionality in Microsoft Excel when using OneDrive. That is core functionality. You would have thought somebody along the way would have tested this, but they hadn't. Now, it's a function that is perhaps not as commonly used by many, and we had to come up with a workaround while they resolved the issue. But, you know, if you've got people that are using sophisticated spreadsheets making sure that those advanced functions still work for them is going to be key. So you've got to do your user testing, because I'll be honest with you, you know, we can test from what we think they need, but getting a real user in there doing real testing, I promise you, you will find things that you didn't expect that you thought were going to be okay. And then you want to make sure your service desk is able to test and understands how to test, because now all of a sudden they're being asked to cover a whole slew of capabilities that they may not have been involved with before. And then if it's at all possible, try and engage a whole team to do some stress testing, because while it may work for a small group of 20 or 30, you know, you put 100 people on there and all of a sudden you may not have sufficient resources allocated to accommodate the heavier use. Like I said, it's that first login time. You know, if you've got everybody logging in between 8 and 9 in the morning, you want to make sure that you're over-provisioned for that time. You may be able to back out afterwards if you have to ship things around. But getting some stress testing done is critical. Otherwise, what happens is users get frustrated. And if they get frustrated, it makes it much harder for them to do their jobs. They will find other ways of trying to get things done because they want to try and remain effective. Or they give up, and you don't want that either. And then, of course, adjusting your bandwidth and configurations once you figure out, okay, these advanced functions are working or not. What have I got to do? I've got the bandwidth. My stress test says, you know what, I'm almost good. Maybe if I add a couple more virtual servers to this cluster, I'll be okay. But making sure that you make those adjustments to ensure that you've got a successful rollout. And then moving on to slide 18, kicking this whole thing off, you want to make sure that you verify that your testing is all complete. Your documentation. I have a couple of users actually in our organization who, while are very, very smart people, they will be upfront and tell you, you know what? I am the worst person when it comes to testing your documentation because I will find everything that could possibly be wrong with it because that's just how I follow these instructions. And so identifying your users that can find the flaws in your documentation actually is really helpful because if your toughest users can get through it okay, then you stand a pretty good chance of eliminating or reducing the number of one-off problems you have in the calls to the service desk. Making sure your training's complete, making sure users have a comfortable level using this new technology, and that your support services are informed, ready, and able to support those teams as they work from home. And then updating your intranet and external websites because we're not doing business as usual right now. This is a new situation. And so making sure that both your internal users and your external customers understand. You know, for example, one of the large local healthcare organizations has it posted on their website and through their version of MyChart indicating, you know what, if you've got certain symptoms, we want you to come in. But you know what, before coming in, we want you to call or have a telehealth session first, so we can triage you before you walk in the door. And so making sure that you're thinking of this from both an internal perspective of your users, but also an external perspective of your customers and your patients, making sure they understand how best to work under these unusual circumstances. And it's really all about communication. I've seen so many times where people go through a lot of the same steps, and they get there, but they don't communicate sufficiently. You can't always count on everybody reading all the emails because, my gosh, we get a lot of emails. So finding other ways to make sure, finding different avenues to get the information to your users and to your customers is critically important. Moving on to slide 19. So we were just talking a moment ago about how this is not business as usual. The question is, once this is over with, are we going to go back to business as usual? So from a telehealth perspective, Jay, one of my associates, did a great call on telehealth. I think it was week before last. If you didn't hear it, download it. It was brilliant. But telehealth has been around for a number of years. Utilization and adoption was very low. All of a sudden, skyrocketing. Do you want to go back to having everybody come in the office, or can you leverage that situation now on an ongoing basis? So part of it is what worked and what didn't. So from a long-term consideration, what are the potential savings of using remote workers instead of everybody coming to the office? Well, one, you won't need as much office space, furnishings, electricity, parking, all those sorts of expenses that you incur today. Another interesting approach is access to resources outside of your immediate geographic area. And it's interesting because I work with clients all across the country, and there are certain areas where, you know what, there's a lot of hospitals and there's a lot of contention for skilled resources. Or it's, you know, a much smaller town where, you know what, getting good resources to move there can be very, very challenging. So one of the nice outcomes of this is you may have now, because if you can offer remote access work, access to better skills, and perhaps less expensive skills. If you're in a major city on one of the coasts, or Chicago, LA, New York, any of these major cities where cost of living is high, you might be able to get access to better skills for less money from people working out of the Midwest. The question gets to also become, what worked for the remote teams successfully, and which did not? Because there are going to be teams that are going to take to this like water. I got this. They run with it. And they're just as effective as they were when they were in the office. And others are going to struggle. And so part of it is identifying which ones are working well and able to keep up and maintain their level of productivity and efficiency and effectiveness, and which ones are having a challenge. Then you got to ask the question, why are they having a challenge? What's difficult? Is it about the culture? I've got people that just aren't used to working from home. They get distracted easily. What can I do to help that? Or is there something in their workflow that is causing them not to be able to function as effectively as before? And so digging into that, because if I look at my crystal ball, we're not going to be able to go back to business as usual. We may not want to go back to business as usual. So now, okay, how can I help these teams that perhaps weren't as effective as they were in the office? Can I still keep them remotely and allow them to work in the same manner? Or, you know what, there may be teams that only work well in person. But I would suggest that many should be able to work well remotely. It's a matter of finding out what were the roadblocks, what were the challenges, and how you can move those out of the way. Let me hand this over on slide 20 to Shefali, because I know we want to leave a couple of minutes for some questions. Shefali, you want to take slide 20, please?
Yes, thank you. So listed here are some recommendations, and as organizations put forth workflows and work with remote work, organizations should track their costs for COVID-19 telehealth security. It can get very expensive, and these will be a lot of unplanned expenses. So some of these costs may be due to increase in bandwidth, purchase of firewalls, purchase of video conferencing tools, purchase of equipment such as laptops, iPhones, and contracting with resources to handle any increase in monitoring of logs and workflows. So once an organization has gathered these, you should look to participate in various relief fund programs that are offered through FCC, FEMA, and the CARES Act. Organizations should look to map out what their security controls will be in place post-COVID-19. Will you develop IT security standards that may need to be revised or will stay as is? And the question is, will our regulations still change or will they go back to pre-COVID-19? So organizations will need to determine if tactical deployments are still supportable and develop a plan to migrate tactical architecture and policies to enterprise standards. I know there's a lot that we've discussed today. There's a lot to consider during this pandemic, but the key is to develop a strategy, a plan, and execute. And this next slide contains the contact information for Eric and I. And this concludes our presentation for today. Does anyone have any questions?
Great. Well, thanks, Shefali and Eric, for providing this very comprehensive framework for how to be managing remote workers. We do have just a few minutes left for phone calls and questions. So if anyone has a question or they'd like to share an experience, they just want to dive in deeper to some of the content that was shared here, just press 5-star on your telephone and we will unmute your line. Just press 5-star. And while we're waiting, I appreciate too that Shefali, you mentioned these relief fund programs that are out there. We certainly heard a good update yesterday around the FCC one in particular related to telehealth. And so if some of this remote infrastructure also is supporting your telehealth program in particular, that's an urgent, just opened up on Monday, a $200 million fund program, and details are available by clicking on the teleconference from yesterday. But again, if anybody else has further questions, just press 5-star on your telephone and we will unmute your line. 5-star. I think this has been an incredibly comprehensive checklist of what people should be doing and what they're working on, and not seeing any more questions and realizing that it pretty much is at the top of the hour. I appreciate very much both of you, Eric Girard, Shefali Mokhtari. Thank you for being here and sharing your insights, and for the continual support to everyone that is out in the field and working remotely during this difficult time. So just a quick call out to everyone on the phone. Please make a point to complete your Pulse teleconference survey. Please check the COVID website link on the Scottsdale Institute teleconference page for further teleconferences. And every Friday morning, you'll be receiving the email that says, here's what's up next on this COVID series. So, Shefali and Eric, thanks again for being here.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Stay safe, stay healthy, stay home. Remote worker, that's it. So thanks all. Talk to you all later. Stay safe. Bye-bye.